I will bring the Committee on Civil Law Data Practices to order. We do have a quorum present. I need someone to move the minutes of March 29th. Representative Gruenhagen moves the minutes of March 29th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 3384. And Representative Hoppe, would you like to move your bill and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register?
Madam Chair, I would. Thank you.
Very good. The bill is before us. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will have a couple of brief comments and turn it over to Ms. Rowan. Life insurers set aside capital reserves to ensure that they will be able to pay back all future expected claims. The current system for calculating those reserves dates back to the Civil War and utilizes a formulaic one-size-fits-all approach. This inflexible, outdated approach locks in certain assumptions that do not allow for changes in economic conditions, more modern product features, interest rate fluctuations, or insurer experience. In response, over the past decade, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, in conjunction with the American Academy of Actuaries, developed the principle-based reserve system. The NAIC's new PBR framework calculates reserves based on a set of fundamental principles rather than the one-size-fits-all formula, and right-sizes reserves by reducing those that are too high for some products and increasing reserves that are too low for others. PBR becomes operational once it has been adopted in at least 42 U.S. jurisdictions, accounting for 75% of U.S. life insurance premiums. To date, 41 states have adopted the necessary legislation, with two states awaiting their governor's final actions. Once these governors sign the legislation, the threshold will be attained. That means that PBR will be in operation on January 1st of next year, of 2017. PBR is supported by the NAIC and the Academy of Actuaries. We thoroughly debated the bill in the Commerce Committee last week, and it passed without a single no vote. Commissioner Rothman, in the interest of full disclosure, Commissioner Rothman does not support PBR. I would like to think he doesn't support it yet, but he doesn't support PBR, and he does not want to enact it this year. If we don't enact it this year, my worry is that our Minnesota-based life insurance companies, who are extremely concerned about being left behind their competitors in all of the states that have approved PBR. So with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Rowan, who's here to talk about their concerns and the data practice provisions.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Good morning, Ms. Rowan. Please state your name for the tape and go on with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MIFSI. MIFSI members offer life insurance, annuities, long-term care, and retirement saving products to Minnesotans, and we support 55,000 Minnesota jobs, including the agents and the financial advisors that distribute our products in every corner of the state. As Chair Hoppe indicated, our Minnesota-based companies believe it's critically important to enact PBR this year. If Minnesota does not adopt PBR during this legislative session, as of 1/1/17, Minnesota-based life insurers will be at a significant competitive disadvantage. And that's because term life reserves under the current formula are extremely onerous, which results in higher prices to consumers as well as trapped capital for insurers. And beginning on 1/1/17, competing insurers in other states that have adopted PBR will be able to offer consumers term life insurance at much lower prices. And this is because PBR does two things. One, it right-sizes reserves, and it recognizes that term life has been overcapitalized for a very long time. But in addition to that, it incorporates new mortality tables. Currently, we're using 2001 mortality tables, and the new ones will be effective 1/1/17 if you have PBR. And the good news is that people are living longer, so that means rates will go down. But if we can't use PBR here in Minnesota, we can't lower our reserves, and we can't lower our prices for consumers. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about I didn't want to get overly insurance-y, but I'm happy to answer any questions, but I thought I'd talk a little bit about the data practices portion of the bill.
Please do.
Since that's why we're here. So this bill, as Representative Hoppe mentioned, is an NAIC model, and the data practices language is model language that was modified to fit within Minnesota's data practices framework. because there are national insurance companies that write in every state that are regulated by individual states, regulators need to share financial data across state lines and occasionally with standard-setting bodies such as the NAIC or the Actuarial Board for Counseling, which is where actuaries go when they've been bad. So in order for the system to work, the materials need to be, the materials that are shared need to have the same level of protection in every state. The protections in this bill apply to different kinds of actuarial memorandum and documents that contain company experience, company risk profiles. And this language isn't new in Minnesota. Virtually identical language and protections can be found in the Holding Company Act, which is 60D.22, and the Own Risk Solvency Act in 60D.57. Those apply to different types of documents, but it's the same protections that were adopted from NAIC model language. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any member questions? Wow, great. Anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in support or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, I would suggest that not everyone in the audience testify in support. I'm sure they're all in favor of it, but
I thought that'd be funnier.
All right. Seeing no one, Representative Hoppe renews his motion. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So have we not heard from the Department of Commerce if the commissioner is opposed? Does he not have someone here, or did he let us know he wasn't going to send someone? It's just
Representative Hoppe.
Representative Hellstrom and Madam Chair, I thought that Assistant Commissioner Brickwood was going to be here, but the commissioner is still not in favor of this passing this year, and I think that's essentially what Assistant Commissioner Brickwood would have said. I thought he was going to be here this morning, but I haven't seen him.
Representative Hellstrom. Maybe it's too early. I don't know. Anyway, any other questions or concerns from members? All right. Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 3384 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You are on your way to the General Register. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lunin, House File 1099. Sounds like a tax form. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lunin. Representative Johnson moves that House File 1099 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Lunin, go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is the first time I have testified in front of this committee. And so following the rules, I brought breakfast, which, by the way, is the most important meal of the day, so help yourself. Those muffins were actually made by a lady at Cub all by herself, so those are handmade.
Very good. We appreciate the goodies this morning. Go ahead with your bill.
Thank you for acknowledging the bill number, the irony of 1099, because this does deal with the relationship between subcontractors and general contractors, the contractual relationship. And when I put together this bill, I consider this a piece of a continuum on improvements to current contractual law or tort law. And what this bill does is it eliminates the ability for a general contractor to contractually require a subcontractor to pay for any of the general contractor's defense costs in a civil action. And the reason I feel this is so important is I come from an insurance background, and if you get litigated, if you get sued for a car accident, for instance, or a business action, your insurance provides coverage for defense costs outside the policy limit on an unlimited basis until the limit of coverage is either paid or offered to be paid. That does not take away from the amount of insurance available to indemnify or pay the victim. However, as a subcontractor, when you incur the responsibility of defense costs for the general contractor or another party, that then is covered and paid for inside your policy and diminishes the coverage that is available to pay the victim. We feel that this is a just a general concept of fairness that anyone who's litigated in a any type of process or contract at all is responsible for paying for their own attorney. Now, we've been working with the Association of General Contractors, and we don't have complete buy-in. We've got some concerns, and frankly, we agree with maybe all of their concerns in that this in the process and some of the things in tort law, there are some problems that have yet to be worked on, and I look forward to working with them down the road to start picking those off one at a time as we can. I have a testifier here today.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Garth Unke. I'm a trial lawyer with the Stitch Angel firm in Minneapolis. I practice in the area of construction defect litigation. Over the last 15 years, I have represented general contractors in over 200 cases. I have represented subcontractors in similar numbers of cases over those years, too. When Representative Lunan asked me to comment on this bill, I didn't even know there was a Minnesota Subcontractors Association at that point in time. He asked me what was fair in terms of indemnification agreements. And I told him three things. One, if you're at fault, you should pay for your damages. If you are at fault, you should pay for your lawyer. And you should buy your own insurance. That's fair. That is the public policy in this state, and it has been so for decades. Before you is an amendment to Section 337 that would add the word defend to the indemnification language. This all stems from perhaps a shortcoming in an amendment that took place in 2013. And this matter was brought before you at that time following a case called the Bolduc case, which created some inequities between general contractors and subcontractors. And ultimately, as a result of that amendment, the law currently reads that a general contractor cannot require a subcontractor to purchase insurance to indemnify the general contractor for the general contractor's own negligence. And those of us who practice in this area of law thought, okay, it's done. There will be no more issue. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. There was a loophole. See, over the last several decades, there has always been a blanket indemnification clause that lumped the words defense, indemnification, and hold harmless together. And creative lawyers, after seeing this amendment to the bill, realize that we can break those words out and separate them. We can say there is a duty to indemnify, and there's a separate duty to defend. So attempts were made to require a subcontractor now to purchase insurance that would require a subcontractor's insurance company to defend the general contractor's negligence. This inequity exists today, much to the dismay, the frustration of a lot of subcontractors, sometimes with disastrous results. In fact, one of our firm clients, Midwest Commercial Exteriors, the proprietor, the former person that ran that business, is not here today, but that business is no longer in existence because of this type of issue. So this is a loophole that has been exploited through, you could say, good lawyering, people representing their clients. But it's a loophole that's not fair. It's a loophole that should be closed, and we're calling upon the legislature to do that. If it's against public policy for someone to require somebody to buy insurance to indemnify them, it should be against public policy to require somebody to purchase insurance to defend them and pay for their lawyers as well. And that's what this all boils down to.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Luna, do you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chairman. I have one other witness that I'd like to come up and testify shortly on this issue.
All right. I have Aaron Dean next. Is that you? Great.
It is.
Thank you for being here. And go ahead with your please state your name and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Aaron Dean. I'm a construction lawyer at Moss & Barnett. I am the current president of the Minnesota Subcontractors Association, and I'm a past chair of the construction law section of the state bar. In 2013, the House unanimously approved an amendment, and the Senate unanimously approved an amendment. And we ask for the defense obligation to no longer be crammed down on subcontractors so that they have to pay for someone else's defense costs. We're so proud that we've been able to work over the last few years to reach this agreement and have Representative Lunan's leadership. And he'll be able to provide to you the 19 trade associations that support this legislation. If there are future questions, if we're lucky enough to be able to pass through this committee and then through the House and Senate, we are certainly open to continuing any other discussions with other stakeholders in the construction industry if they still have concerns. What we're looking for, though, is for House File 1099 to be passed, and any future concerns, we'll address them at that time. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Member questions for any of these two testifiers? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lunan, testifiers. My understanding of this bill, and the previous testifier brought it up, the 2013 law that we passed that was supposed to clarify this issue. Apparently, we have some very good lawyers that learn how to read between the lines and find ways around the intent of what our legislation was. So, Representative Lunan, I want to thank you for bringing this forward to clarify the intent of the law we passed in 2013. I was on the Civil Law Committee at that time, and I can verify that was the intent, to require the general contractors to defend themselves and to hold the subcontractors that had no part of the issue, make them so if they weren't part of the issue, they would not have to pay.
Any other member questions? Seeing none, let's go on down the testifier list. Scott Anderson? Or Andreessen? And on deck is Becker. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee. My name is Scott Andreessen. I'm an attorney at the Bassford Remley Law Firm. I'm a construction attorney. I've practiced in the construction arena for about 16 years. I've had quite a few cases against both Mr. Unke and Mr. Dean, so I know them well and certainly respect them as attorneys. I disagree with them wholeheartedly about a number of items. And let me start with the last issue that was raised, which is the 2013 bill. I was part of the discussions at that time about the bill that passed that they're now saying we're clarifying or closing a loophole. This is not a loophole. This was, in fact, and we can, if we need to, provide you with all kinds of emails that talk about the fact that the defense and indemnity were intentionally separated in 2013 because of the concerns related to insurance. And everybody understood at the time that when you have an indemnification provision and when you have obligations to indemnify, whether that go from a sub up to a general or a general up to an owner, that you can get insurance for that defense obligation, right? So everybody understood that, and therefore it was separated from the indemnification piece of it. That was not a loophole. This is not a clarification. It is something, it is a change of heart, is what it is. There was an agreement, and Mr. Dean represented that this bill passed unanimously back in 2013. It passed unanimously because we all reached an agreement. We had meetings. We had stakeholder meetings with owners, general contractors, subcontractors, trades, attorneys, representatives, senators, and we crafted legislation that all of the different stakeholders could live with. That's why it passed unanimously. We don't have that now, because what's being done by this bill is going back and saying we want to change things about the 2013 legislation. We've had a change of heart. And I'd also very respectfully take issue with the overall introduction from Representative Lunan, which is this is a bill that seeks to address an inequity between general contractors and subcontractors. Chapter 337, which is what you're seeking to amend here by this bill, applies to the construction industry as a whole. This is not a statute that only applies to generals and subs. It applies to the entire industry, architects, engineers, owners, both public and private. Although one of the concerns that the Association of General Contractors has about this bill is some elements of the state of Minnesota, particularly the Department of Administration, and the University of Minnesota, take the position that 337 does not apply to them. And so we have a concern that what you're doing is you're not just changing the law as it pertains to generals and subs. You're changing the law as it pertains to construction projects. And what you're going to have if you pass this bill is you're going to have public projects, many public projects, in which the owner will be able to say to the general contractor, you have to indemnify and defend the owner against any claims, irrespective of fault. But the general contractor won't be able to pass that down to subcontractors, and subcontractors won't be able to pass it down to lower tier subcontractors. And so really all we're doing here is we're just shifting who gets stuck with this bill. And in reality, the way that the system is set up now was an intentional decision by the industry as a whole to say we're going to insure our construction projects, and the parties who are closest to the risk are going to end up carrying that insurance, right? So if you look at it from this standpoint, from a fairness standpoint is what I keep hearing about, is that this is about fairness. And fairness, some would say, is that one party should not be able to require another party to defend the first party from the first party's responsibility. As a general matter, that I can understand why that would appeal to everybody's fairness meter. But what people, I think, fail to understand and what this bill doesn't understand is that in the construction industry and throughout the law in the state of Minnesota, we have a concept called vicarious liability. General contractors are liable for the negligent acts of their subcontractors by law, not by this statute, and this doesn't do anything to address that. Okay? So if fairness, if we're talking about, well, everybody should just be responsible for their own fault, as Mr. Unke suggested, again, that sounds, it makes good common sense, but that's not how the law works. We have vicarious liability principles. If a subcontractor makes a mistake, the general contractor is on the hook for that mistake to the owner, whether they like it or not, and it has nothing to do with this law. That's common law in the state of Minnesota. So is it unfair that the general contractor should be able to enter into a contract with the sub that says, hey, if I get sued arising out of your work, you should have to defend and indemnify me? That doesn't seem unfair at all in light of the fact that we have vicarious liability. It is not conversely true. Subcontractors are not vicariously liable for the acts of the general contractor. It's backwards. And all I would suggest to this committee and to Representative Lunan, which is what I suggested to him when we met last week, is that doing this in a piecemeal fashion is going to create a problem in our industry. It's going to create a problem for the contracts. It's going to create a problem for public projects and private projects alike. Mr. Beckert will talk a little bit more about some of the insurance implications of what this seeks to do. I would simply ask Representative Lunan and the committee to hold this over so that all of the stakeholders can do what we did in 2013, talk about it, figure out if there's a way to address everybody's concerns at the same time, and not do this one piece at a time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Mark Becker, please state your name for the record. Go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Mark Becker, and I am an attorney with the Fabianski, Westra, Hart & Thompson law firm. I practice construction law. I've been doing so for 16 years. I represent owners, general contractors, subcontractors, also design professionals, including architects and engineers, also some developers. And so I've seen the issue from every angle that you could imagine. And what I want to talk about here is just some focused comments that we have on the particular legislation that's at hand. The Amendment 1099, and I'm sorry, before I go to I do appreciate Representative Lunan's commitment to work with people to try to iron things out whenever that might be. That I think that's going to be helpful because there are some concerns that at least I see in this. In Part C of Section 2, the way the legislation was originally crafted was that the prohibition on buying insurance to covered to one or more other parties for their own negligence. There was an exception to that for project-specific insurance, including without limitation, builder's risk policies, owner or contractor-controlled insurance programs or policies. And what the bill proposes to do is delete the words or project-specific insurance, including without limitation. And I can go back to 2013 because, like Mr. Andreessen, I was also involved in that effort with the 2013 bill. The reason that particular language was included is because there are a variety of insurance products that are available to provide insurance for the construction industry that are available on a project basis. Those include things like pollution liability policies, owner's protective professional liability indemnity policies, construction protective liability policies, and all of these different types of policies, and I'm only naming just a few, are available as a risk management tool for owners to require of contractors, for contractors required of subs. And there are all kinds of insurance products that can be bought on a project-specific basis, and new ones can come out all the time as well. The reason for that project-specific insurance is because typically that will be priced by the subcontractor or general contractor as a specific cost item that whoever their customer is will pay. So it doesn't affect the underlying overall premiums for the commercial general liability policy that is at issue in the discussion you have. So we're talking about different policies than the focus of the comments so far. I could foresee that if this bill passed without keeping that in or somehow clarifying it, that what you're going to do is you're going to impact the insurance market. You're going to basically potentially make unavailable insurance products that are useful to the construction industry as a risk management tool, and that could actually have a material impact not only on the construction industry but also on the insurance industry. And I'm not sure that particular piece of it has been fully vetted out. Secondly, I think Mr. Andreessen alluded to it already, is the bill affects indemnification agreements, but only in building and construction contracts. The definition in the overall bill, 337.01, defines building and construction contracts pretty broadly, but it doesn't identify it with exactitude, whether it applies to public projects or private projects. And so what has become an issue, and I think there was an allusion to creative lawyering, is some lawyers that represent owners will say, well, this whole statutory regime doesn't apply to our project because we're a public owner and it doesn't apply to us. And so you have an ambiguity potentially as to whether this whole statutory regime applies to some projects or not the others. We think that should be clarified. If some jobs are to be exempt, then that to me, that should be clarified. Without that clarification, you could have a lot of unnecessary litigation that's expensive about whether this entire statutory regime applies, you know, just at the general contractor or general contractor subcontractor level, or also at the owner general contractor level, to some owners and not others. That's worthy of clarification, I see. And I'd also like to respond to one of the comments made, I think, by Mr. Unke, that I just want to address the issue from an insurance coverage standpoint. I do a fair amount of insurance coverage work. I think the assertion was made that if a subcontractor provides a defense to the contractor, that the defense cost would erode the limits available on the underlying policy. That's not been my experience. There's a provision in almost all commercial general liability policy is called supplementary payments A and B. That supplementary payment provision actually provides that when there's an indemnification or defense provided to the indemnity, that would be paid on top of limits. That's just my observation and experience with that particular provision.
Representative Johnson, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question for this testifier. I'm just wondering if you can answer this question for me. Who is responsible for the overall construction project, the general contractor or the sub?
Well, I would say the owner would be, because it's the owner's ultimate project. They're the ones who hire an architect. They're the ones who hire the general contractor. The general contractor hires the subcontractors and trades to provide the project. Many owners, so this is, you know, one of my focus areas is also project delivery methods. A lot of public owners will use a project delivery method, and that's just a fancy word for how they contract the work. They'll hire a construction manager to serve as the owner's representative on the project. That construction manager will not actually provide any labor. They'll just manage it. All of the contractors that you would call a subcontract, those are going to be prime to the owner. And so in that circumstance, you know, I think it would be the owner ultimately is going to be responsible for the construction project.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I've been involved in a few construction projects, not on the public side, but on the private side. And the general contractor is the one that reports to the owner. The owner hires him to manage the project, to build the project, to make sure everything is done properly. If he's not doing, his subcontractor is not doing something properly, it's the general contractor that steps in to take care of the problem. He's the one overall responsible for that project. Why should a subcontractor pay for his legal fees if he's not doing his job?
Well, my understanding is, thank you. May I respond?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair. Okay. To that particular point, if the situation is the general contractor hires a sub and the subcontractor's, you know, work isn't correct, the first thing that the general contractor would do is ask the subcontractor to fix it. And typically, the subcontractor will fix it, and there's never any issues. That happens as a daily occurrence all the time, and that's just the way the construction industry works. What happens is sometimes the subcontractor will, you know, you might have a large project where the general contractor can't have eyes on every piece that goes on, and so things do slip through the cracks. And we're talking about, I think, the general context of this is the construction defect case, where there is a latent defect that nobody caught. It stems from the subcontractor's work, so the subcontractor should be responsible for the work. After all, they did it. And the general contractor, you know, also could have some responsibility for, you know, not providing the adequate supervision. So it's a combined thing, and what we're talking about is the defense. Ultimately, this is subcontractor's work.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, you sort of answered my question in a way without, I don't think you realize you answered it. I'm making my point. The general contractor is responsible. You even admitted that he is responsible because he didn't do his job. Well, so he should be paying that part of the bill as well for defending himself.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Yeah, ultimately the general contractor is going to be fully responsible to the owner for all of the construction issues that might occur. And what we're talking about is, you know, what is the fair allocation for that responsibility when it stems from a subcontractor's work. I don't think the subcontractor would have no responsibility. I don't think anybody that practices construction law would say that. But that's kind of the push point for what we're talking about.
Other member questions for these two testifiers? Seeing no one. Representative Lunin, do you have any comments in between here before we call up the next?
Yes, I do. The comment that the payment for the defense cost for the general contractor under the subcontractor's policy does diminish the coverage. I just got to do the math here because, first of all, I don't get to correct an attorney very often. And when I add up the total years these two have been in law, add one more to that number, and that's how long I've been doing insurance. In 2013, I wasn't here to negotiate that. I was out implementing these type of coverages. And when the subcontractor assumes in a contract the responsibility to defend the general contractor, that gets picked up under the contractual law coverage under the general liability. So it's pulled out. That part does get paid out of the policy itself. The subcontractor, the actual defense costs they incur, the testifier is exactly right, does get picked up under the supplemental coverage and is outside the policy limit and doesn't take it down at all. The simple look at this is the general contractor, if not always, certainly often, gets profit and overhead on the work that the subcontractor does. And what comes with that benefit of receiving that compensation is the responsibility of vetting the subcontractors, which this bill certainly will heighten that it's important to work with good subs and also make sure that those subcontractors are hiring the people below them, that they are valid as well. I agree with all of the concerns they have, and that's what my comment about working with them going forward. I absolutely see that there. I don't know a way to do this all in one move, And so I'm just doing what I can. So what this is a sense of direction, part of the continuum. All those problems that they talked about are exactly, they're right there, and others. As far as the relationship between the general contractor and the owner, I have concerns about municipal immunity. When a general contractor has to do the work or compel the sub to do the work based on what a building inspector tells them, and it's not going to function, it's going to fail. And then when there's a problem with that, the general contractor gets stuck with that. These are all the things I am eagerly looking forward to working with going forward.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I make one comment in response?
Mr. Andreessen.
Just to the question that Representative Lunan raised about he doesn't know how to address all of this in one fell swoop, and that may not be possible to tackle vicarious liability. But when I met with Representative Lunan, one of the things we discussed was this issue of public owners. And he said, propose some language. What I agree. Give me some language, what would it look like? And we did that. And we had an amendment drafted and more than 24 hours before this hearing that would do just that. That it would just, all it deals with is the issue of making sure that this statute clarifies that it applies to public owners, the state and municipalities. That's a simple thing. There are more things that need to be done to fix this bill, but if the committee is going to go forward, we have provided an amendment to Representative Lunan that would just fix that one so that we don't have this inequity between public owners and generals that you're seeking to correct between generals and subs. So I'd ask that if you're going to move the bill forward, that you take that into consideration.
Our next testifier, thank you for your testimony. I have Rob Moshet and Jim County. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Moshet. I'm a trial lawyer representing the Minnesota Builders Association. I also do construction defect litigation, both for general contractors and subcontractors. I wish to echo most of the points that were made by Mr. Becker and Mr. Andreessen, but I also want to bring to the committee's attention that insofar as residential contractors are concerned, we have a special concern in addition to the concerns that have already been expressed, and that is residential contractors are required by law to be licensed. As a condition of licensure, residential contractors must carry certain minimum limits of comprehensive general liability coverage. Subcontractors, defined in the law as specialty contractors, are not required to be licensed. And they are not required to carry insurance. It is the policy of the state of Minnesota in the field of residential construction to require that insurance be carried on these residential projects. But the only way that a general contractor, a residential contractor, can require a specialty contractor to carry insurance is by means of a contract. The contract with the subcontractor can require the sub to carry the CGL coverage. Under the CGL coverage that the subcontractor pays for coverage for itself, as Representative Lunan pointed out, that coverage also covers the indemnity obligation that the subcontractor, the specialty contractor, assumes in the contract. And there are different policy forms. Many of the policy forms pay for the defense obligation in the form of supplementary benefits and do not erode the limits of coverage. The point I want to make here is that in the field of residential construction, where the general contractor is required to carry insurance, but the specialty contractor is not required to carry insurance, I would caution the committee against passing this bill that may have unintended consequences on the defense obligations that are already insured when the subcontractor obtains its own insurance. This is a complex area, and the insurance industry, as stakeholders in this area, should be consulted, and they should be at this table as well. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this specific testifier? Seeing none, we will go on. Thank you for your testimony. We'll go on to Mr. County. Go ahead and state your name for the record. I'm sorry if I botched it. Go ahead.
Nope, that was, Madam Chair, my name is Jim County. I'm Assistant Chief Counsel with MnDOT.
Go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. It's not clear that this bill is intended to apply to the state, but to the extent that it does apply to the state, MnDOT has three concerns about this bill that I'd like to address with you briefly. First, this will call into question the enforceability of a MnDOT standard specification which requires the prime contractor to defend MnDOT for the contractor's acts, omissions, claims are based out of their operations. And also, most local governments in the state also use MnDOT's contract for their road and bridge projects. Secondly, the law mentions specific types of insurance, as Mr. Becker alluded to, and it kind of omits other insurance that forms an important piece of kind of the overall puzzle of insurance that owners might require contractors to carry on projects, like commercial general liability insurance, like commercial auto insurance, like pollution liability insurance, as Mr. Becker mentioned. And finally, and you know, probably most importantly, it's kind of upends the traditional allocation of risk on construction projects and kind of the long-standing standard that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And we fear that upending this traditional standard rather than decreasing litigation might actually increase litigation on construction projects, as parties will have to litigate all the way to the allocation of fault on a project. And then parties will have to thereafter seek to recoup their defense costs. So those are MnDOT's concerns with this bill, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. County. Any member questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Lunin, we will give you the last word.
Madam Chair, members, this bill is designed for fairness and to make sure that everyone is responsible for their part in the play. And again, and as all the testifiers have conveyed, there's a whole process. There's a lot of issues around here. The great thing about this bill is now I know who to call next year when I'm working on the next aspects of it. That'll do well. But there are other problems. This is just doing as much of the right thing as we can at this time. So I appreciate a green vote.
Thank you. Thank you for that. With that, Representative... Who moved this bill? Did I move it? Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1099 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Loon. And House File 1099 is going to the General Register. Representative Lesh.
Is anything good? What? Claire's coming.
Representative Lesh, would you like to move House File 2741 and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, I would so move, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And I believe that there is a DE2-1 amendment?
Yes, there is, Madam Chair. Just for the clarification of the committee, the only change between the DE1 to the DE2 was incorporation of some minor changes suggested by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association in order to clean the bill up a little bit. We've been doing a lot of that.
All right. I will move the DE2-1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE2-1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lesh, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for sake of committee members' knowledge, we had a very constricted hearing in public safety. It was very short, and so there's some opportunity to get some points out here in this committee that I want to go to. Originally, my interest in this issue came about, folks may remember the story of Ratia Parsons. In 2011, in November, she's a 15-year-old Canadian girl from Nova Scotia who was unpopular in her school and got invited to a party with the football team who got her drunk and proceeded to rape her and then filmed it. The pictures of it went around the school immediately thereafter. And she endured about a year's worth of taunts, things like slut and whore, until she finally took her own life the following spring. And she left on life support about 3 days before that ended. And that struck me at the time, and it really, I didn't know what to do about it, honestly, and I thought about this for a couple years. Until through last legislative session, there was pending the court case that Representative Hillstrom is familiar with, which struck down our Minnesota criminal defamation law on the grounds that it was pretty old, archaic. It did not comply with fundamental 1960s Supreme Court rulings. So in putting this together, I did so with taking a look at Representative Hillstrom's bill, also Representative Mack's bill on image exploitation. And what we arrived at was a bill that addresses the Isani County situation. It also addresses image exploitation and the proliferation of digital images used to exploit individuals, especially our young people here in Minnesota and the United States of America. Folks, you should know that why is this such a problem now? And at the time of that court decision last April that struck down Minnesota's criminal defamation law, I did a quick search of how many images were taken. Well, by that time in 2015, April of 2015, there were already more images taken in 2015 than there were throughout the entire 20th century. That gives you a little bit of an idea of how pervasive this problem is and why we need to address it and why things are different now than they were before. Just to give you a sense of who we worked with in pulling together the working group last summer and who participated, Representative Tara Mack, Representative Deborah Hillstrom, St. Paul City Attorney Samuel Clark, Minneapolis City Attorney Susan Siegel, Jeff Edblatt, Isani County Attorney, who had the Isani County case, Robert Small with Minnesota County Attorney Association, John Archigo, who actually was the defense attorney in the Isani County case and had a lot of good input on the law, Chuck Samuelson with the ACLU, Gene Ronayne, Executive Director of MnCASA, and we have Caroline Palmer here with us today, Carrie Goldberg, an attorney who practices specifically in this area in Manhattan, Dr. Marianne Franks, law professor at the University of Miami School of Law, Raina Alexander, Bad Women's Legal Advocacy Project, Sophia Khan, Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, Charlie Clippert, representation for the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Joel Carlson, Minnesota Association for Justice, and multiple individuals who experienced this crime individually. So with that, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I would like to introduce initially my testifiers here today, and my citizen testifiers, I'll allow them to introduce themselves, if it's okay.
You bet. Please proceed. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Go ahead and state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Claire Vissel, and I am a high school senior here in St. Paul. I'm here today because last year, a fellow classmate of mine took several explicit upskirt images of me on school property and then proceeded to post them on a porn website. They were without my consent, without even my knowledge, and this happened to multiple other girls, about 19 other girls. And then I attempted to prosecute this individual, and I found after about 6 months of work with the St. Paul Police Department that there was no bill or law that would prosecute him for taking these images and then distributing them amongst a porn website where there was enough personal information for other people to identify me and the other girls and communicate with us via Facebook and proceed to stalk several other girls. There was no law that could prosecute him or have any justice for me and several other women. So I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. I think it would have been very helpful in helping my case and helping bring some justice to the situation. Thank you.
Thank you for your concise testimony. I appreciate that. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Williams, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have to be honest. I was scared to do this. I still am scared. I'm scared I'll talk too much or not enough. I'm scared I won't provide enough detail and depth or too much. I'm frightened if I don't speak to you all and say the exact words you need to hear, this bill won't pass and my nightmare will continue to exist unprotected by law. I'm afraid I'll confide in you all here today and only be heard rather than understood. But the truth is, my testimony will never allow you to fully understand the horror I am feeling. At this point, my only hope is that my testimony keeps any other victim of this appalling crime from having to do what I'm doing right now, standing in front of strangers, trying to convince these strangers that what happened to me is a crime, knowing some of you might not believe me. If Bill HF 2741 passes, it will be the biggest relief and comfort knowing that I don't have to live with the unknown and that I'm protected by law. At 19 years old, I was unknowingly filmed by hidden webcam during my very first sexual encounter with my then 24-year-old boyfriend of a year and a half. I didn't find out about it until much later, and upon my request, thought it was deleted. After finally escaping this abusive relationship this past fall, I thought I was finally free from him and his manipulation, control, and abuse. But just less than 2 weeks ago, fueled by jealousy, he reappeared in my life in a manner I could not ignore. He texted me saying that he was glad he still had the sex tape of me and that he threatened to share it with everyone and to destroy my life in the process, saying he had very little to lose at this point. That was and is still very terrifying. These are not just idle threats. I'm once again in fear, just a different type of fear. I'm here today sharing my story in hopes that you can empathize with me and all other women who have and will be put in this unfortunate position. Please do the right thing and take action. This could happen to someone who is near and dear to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Legal Affairs Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I wish to thank Representative Lesh for all of his hard work on this issue, and I also want to acknowledge the bravery of these young women for coming forward to the committee today and to thank them for speaking. I also would like to acknowledge all of the work Representative Lesh has done to pull together so many stakeholders to talk about this very complex issue. It really touches many different parts of our laws, and there really has been a need to bring together many different points of view to balance all of the privacy and First Amendment concerns that come up. MnCASA represents about 60 sexual assault advocacy programs throughout the state, and all of them have seen this issue in some way with the survivors that they assist. Many advocates have helped victims who have been the subjects of online harassment, stalking, and abuse, including the non-consensual dissemination of private images. This violation can really have very serious repercussions for a victim's health and well-being. And as is often the case with sexual violence, they also can incur many victim-blaming comments. Sometimes people say, what did you expect if you shared this image with somebody else? Well, they expected privacy, especially in an intimate partner relationship when they felt they could trust their partner. We also see that this doesn't really require a prior relationship to occur. Recently, we heard about a hacker in the news who took images of Oscar-winning actress Jennifer Lawrence, for example, and posted them online and really caused a discussion that overshadowed all of her considerable professional achievements. And as Representative Lesh noted earlier, there can be filmed sexual assaults, and a particular concern in situations in which the victim is incapacitated and has no way of consenting at all to what has been happening to her or to the dissemination of the images. We have discussed this issue in MnCASA's Public Policy Committee. We have a number of attorneys who are part of that conversation, and we're really glad to see that there are criminal remedies, that there are civil remedies, that there's an approach to our harassment restraining orders, to domestic violence orders, and also to our stalking statute. It's a very comprehensive approach. It's also really important for us that there is a cause of action presented in this bill. As I mentioned earlier, there really can be serious emotional or even physical harm, as well as economic loss incurred by victims. There can also be undue profit on the part of the person who disseminates the image. It's really particularly good for us to see in this legislation a civil fine for noncompliance and also protections for the confidentiality of the victim. And a really important piece for those who are concerned about the First Amendment and free speech protections is that there are exceptions to liability which recognizes instances in which images may be held or disseminated for legal purposes, for medical, scientific, or public purposes. And finally, in the public safety hearing, we talked a bit about the First Amendment and the issue of specific intent in this bill. We, like others, always want to ensure that First Amendment rights are respected. But when a person intentionally and non-consensually disseminates an image, a private image of somebody that is sexual in nature, we really need to make sure that there is a criminal or civil remedy for the victim. Both of these young women proved that to us today. This bill does include aggravating factors that are especially concerning is when a person disseminates a sexually explicit image of another and also does so for profit or to even create a harmful situation for the victim. And again, this bill in the criminal area does include exceptions so that we are still protecting speech. This really is a critical point where free speech and privacy rights meet. We must find a balance and recognize the responsibility that a person has when they control a private image of another person. Representative Lesh and the many stakeholders that have worked on this bill are very aware of this critical point and have worked diligently to achieve this balance in this legislation. I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Are there questions for any of these testifiers? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the testifiers for their just really powerful and courageous testimony. So thank you for sharing that. And also want to thank Representative Lesh for his work on this. And I had the chance to work with Caroline Palmer from MnCASA in my work outside the legislature, and she does incredible work in this on behalf of survivors of sexual violence and preventing sexual violence too. So thank you. And I think this is terrific. I do have a concern along with the ACLU about just making sure that this would be upheld in against any constitutional challenges. So I guess I had a question for Representative Lesh about the fact that portions of the bill include a requirement that the individual would have had a reason to know that the target, the person whose images are being disseminated, would be frightened or threatened or oppressed or persecuted. They have some reason to believe that. And I guess I wanted to find out, because that's in some portions of the bill, not in others. And I want to see what your thought was as to why that's included in some areas and not in others.
Representative Lesh.
Maybe Representative Pinto can clarify portions of the bill requiring that the person who posted the image know that they would feel frightened or threatened?
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in both the civil area and the criminal, there's some places where there's a requirement that the person either know or have reason to know that the person would feel harassed, frightened, threatened, oppressed, etc. Some places where that's a requirement and some places where it's not. And I guess I had some further thoughts on this, but it was included. So, for example, in the civil area, the cause of action area, the non-consensual sexual solicitation, there is a requirement that the actor know or have reason to know that the person would feel persecuted, etc. In terms of dissemination of private sexual images, there's not that requirement. And then similarly in the criminal area, in some parts it is, in some parts it's not.
Representative Lesh.
The reason we arrived at that, Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, is to strike a balance. There's no question that we want to make sure that this is done. There are efforts by some who say that we should ensure that this was done maliciously. And there are some instances when there's no question maliciousness is a factor, but there are other instances where maliciousness needn't necessarily be a factor. For example, example brought up by Ms. Palmer in the Jennifer Lawrence case. Motives should not necessarily
be required. The motive to know that someone, that you were threatening someone or that they should be threatened, should be required in some cases and not all cases. So I'd have to look over again at the specific instances because the bill was arrived at over the course of 4 months. And so when those changes were specifically made, I can't recall. But I know they were done based upon an attempt to achieve a balance and agreement with other stakeholders.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to be clear, I will definitely be supporting the bill today, no question at all. But I may want to connect with you, Representative Lashley, just to, because I guess I do see a couple places where I think, potentially anyway, and I've been working on it and even longer, I know, than 4 months. And I certainly don't have the benefit of that, but may want to talk with you. Because it is occurring to me that there may be some places where there's no requirement of specific intent, certainly, but it may be that including the idea that there should be reasonable belief of recognizing this would be harassing to somebody could in fact have some real benefits in terms of being able to protect this against a court challenge.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hillstrom. Representative Lesh, did you want to respond?
Well, Your Honor, I actually have a really great answer for Representative Pinto, because now I remember that Ms. Perius reminded me. But why don't I just answer offline, because it gets into some in-depth scenarios and legalese that would probably take us afield. But I've got a good answer, trust me.
All right. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lash. Thank you for including me in the working group. It has been an incredible experience on working on this issue. I brought it up during the working group, and I want to put it on the record so that there's no question of legislative intent as we move forward. One of the issues that I wanted to make sure that we covered is that we didn't make it easier for people who were doing child pornography and distributing images of children. It's my understanding that in the previous DE amendment that you had some language in there to ensure that you could continue to prosecute those cases. Did you keep that in the DE2 language? And if you could point that out for folks, what your intention is to make certain that, you know, members, what you don't want to do is by addressing one issue that you make it easier on someone else. And so Representative Lesh has been very willing to work on the issue of making certain that we can still prosecute people who distribute child pornography and that this is meant to deal with folks who are in an intimate relationship.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, yes, it's still in there. It's on lines 10.14 to 10.16.
And Representative Lesh, it is your intent to allow the prosecution of child pornography separate from this as well?
Yes.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes.
Okay. Any other questions from members for these testifiers? Are there any other testifiers, Representative Lesh?
I'm sure there probably are. They'll come down, but I mean, not pro. I didn't have anyone sign up.
Okay, you didn't have anybody else on your agenda. Okay, very good. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, and no other member question. Representative Johnson has a question.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't have a question. I have more of a comment. Are you one of the issues that brought this forward to you is the case in Isani County? I do know quite a bit about that case and the devastation it caused because of the lack of what they could do. It was real devastating to the family involved. I want to thank you for bringing this issue forward and trying to get to the crux of the problem.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions or members of the audience wishing to testify, Representative Lesh renews his motion that...
If I could, just a closing comment on this.
Sure. Representative Lesh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I did want to bring up and address what has been voiced in opposition in terms of the First Amendment concerns about this. And I want to stress to everyone on this committee that this is first and foremost an issue of personal privacy, not an issue of First Amendment rights. I want to make that indelibly clear. And the Supreme Court has time and again made clear that privacy is a fundamental right, okay? Just like free speech, it is a fundamental right. There is no question that it could potentially bleed into the area of First Amendment. However, the court has also stated there are certain low-value forms of speech that do not receive the full protection of the First Amendment. and that purely private matters fall into this category. So that is established Supreme Court jurisprudence. Further, there are numerous state and federal laws prohibiting the unauthorized distribution of private information. This committee deals with that all the time. Trade secrets, medical records, driver's license, social security numbers, all those are private and are not free speech. So when people come around and talk to you subsequently and try to tell you that this is free speech, including anyone representing the Media Coalition, who a quick check over the 100 highlights of their successes in the last 40 years primarily dealt with pornography distributors, by the way, just make sure that you know that and keep that aware in your head. We must protect the First Amendment, but not at the expense of a bill like this, which is aimed at individuals' personal privacy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Lesh, for bringing this bill. Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 2741, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Lesh, and testifiers. Representative O'Neill. Welcome to the committee. Representative Hoppe moves House File 2552 that it be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative O'Neill. We'll take up House File 2552, obviously, first.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2552 applies to subsequent and extensions for orders of protection. It mirrors the current process for initial OFPs, which allows for hearings to be waived if the respondent and the petitioner do not request a hearing. In Section 1, it amends Minnesota Statute 518B.01, Subdivision 6A, to allow for a limited relief OFP. And I want to express limited relief OFP to be granted without a hearing. And that happens only after the respondent has had notice and opportunity to be heard, and only after the respondent chooses not to have a hearing. This legislation maintains the same protections, processes, and timelines for the respondents to request a hearing that currently exists in the initial limited relief OFP proceedings. Sections 2 and 3 are conforming changes. I have with me today Rebecca Moses from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women to speak in support of the bill.
Good morning, Ms. Moses. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, and I want to extend a special thanks for scheduling us. We know there are lots of bills, and it's a short session, so we thank you for that. My name is Rebecca Moses, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We're an association of 83 programs that provide sexual and domestic violence services across the state of Minnesota. To echo what Representative O'Neill said, we're here today to briefly discuss hearings for petitions that extend orders for protection that have limited relief. And so under current statute, certain initial orders for protection that provide limited relief can be granted without a hearing, but only if the respondent chooses to waive the right to that hearing. However, an extension of a limited relief order for protection requires a hearing, even if the petitioner and the respondent do not want a hearing for this limited relief OFP. This hearing requirement utilizes judiciary resources that could be more efficiently invested elsewhere. HF 2552 addresses this issue by allowing limited relief orders for protection to be granted without a hearing only after, one, the respondent has been personally served notice, two, the respondent has had an opportunity to be heard, and three, the respondent then chooses not to request a hearing. This legislation maintains the same protections, processes, and timelines for respondents to request a hearing that currently exist in the initial limited relief order for protection proceedings. We ask for your support of this legislation. Thank you for your time, and I'll stand for any questions the committee members may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any member questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually just want to thank Representative O'Neill for her leadership on this and the next bill. I work closely with Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women outside the legislature, my work, and get to work with Rebecca Moses. So just want to say thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other member questions or comments? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 2552 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you for this House file. You're on your way to the General Register. And next up is 2553. I guess these were filed together.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Consecutive numbers. Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes, this is in the same section, similar section. So House File 553 amends Minnesota Statute 518B.01, Subdivision 3A, and it waives respondent filing fees for orders of protection. And for the details, I'm going to go to Rebecca Moses again.
Thank you. And before we do that, I will move House File 2553, that it be re-referred to Ways and Means. Ms. Moses, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'll just state that I'm Rebecca Moses with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. This secondary bill that we're working on addresses the issue of respondents being charged filing fees to access the court in order for petition, in order for protection proceedings. Excuse me. Current statute waives the filing fees for petitioners in order for protection proceedings. However, current statute gives the court's discretion to charge respondents a filing fee in those same proceedings. The Domestic Abuse Act has always allowed respondents to be charged filing fees, but this rarely occurred. Now, some district courts are beginning to charge respondents. For instance, Hennepin and Ramsey County, with the highest volume of orders for protection petitions, are charging. Other counties, such as Washington, Otter Tail, and Crow Wing, are also requiring filing fees. So how much are the filing fees? They're approximately $310 plus library and technology fees, so you're looking at about $330 just to get access to the courts. If petitioner filing fees are waived, it's inherently unfair to charge respondents filing fees. It creates an unequal system and a due process concern. While petitioners pay nothing to fully engage in the process, respondents are being required to pay $330 to access the courts, creating a barrier for respondents' opportunity to be heard. HF 2553, again, addresses this issue by waiving respondent filing fees, which creates a fairer system by allowing both parties the same access to the courts. We would again ask for your support of HF 2553. Thank you for your time, and I'll stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, I will renew my motion that House File 2553 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. You're on your way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative O'Neill and Ms. Moses.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, I don't know if you've been before this committee or not.
I try to avoid it.
Well, welcome to the committee. Representative Lohmer moves House File 1182 that it be re-referred to the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really briefly, what this piece of legislation does is it allows for folks to check off organ donation on a website that's a part of the hunting and fishing license operation. The section of the bill that is dealing with this area is about the data piece and making sure that it stays private. So that's it.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Do you have a testifier?
Only if needed.
Only if needed. Very good. Are there member questions? I think this is a great bill. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Our organization, Citizens Council for Health Freedom, I'm Twyla Braze, president of that organization. We don't oppose this bill for is perhaps more information for the public. I don't know how many of you were here in 2006 when the Darlene Luther Act was passed, but one of our long-standing concerns about the act is that, yes, if you make a donation and you check off wherever, you do make a donation. But the act also says, if, for example, I did not check off a box, the Act says that unless I actually refuse, and you can find the paper that says that I refused, then I am eligible for being donated. So my concern with this is that the public doesn't understand, and every time they see one of those boxes, they think that the only way that their organs could be donated is if they check off one of those boxes. And we would like the educational piece of this to be stronger. And I mentioned to Representative Anderson that on line 2.2, it would be great to add something to the effect after the period, or another and, in other words. We would like people to know the fact that unless you actually do a refusal, your organs can be donated without your consent. And Chapter 525A.09 actually says that unless you have either revoked your decision to become a donor or you have an actual refusal that someone can find, your organs can be donated, and there is a list of all the individuals who can make those decisions and in what order. We are afraid that the Minnesota public believes that their organs cannot be donated, cannot be taken, unless they have checked off one of those forms, and that's not true, and this is an opportunity to give them that kind of information while they're thinking about organ donation.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My testifier is available to answer any questions on that issue.
All right. Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Thank you for being here, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Susan Mal Larson, and I am with LifeSource. LifeSource is a federally designated nonprofit organization that manages organ and tissue donation throughout the state of Minnesota. And I would like to specifically address the Darlene Luther Act, the Anatomical Gift Act, that regulates how donation decisions are managed and fulfilled. It is true that when someone designates themselves as a donor on a donor registry or their driver's license, we do honor and respect that decision and fulfill that decision. In the absence of that decision, we ask the family what they would choose, and it is the next of kin's decision to choose whether their loved one would want to be a donor, they would want them to be a donor on their behalf. So donation is never imposed on anybody, it's simply a choice made by individuals, by ourselves, to help the thousands of people waiting, or a choice made by a family member in the absence of that decision.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas has a question.
Well, not a question, Madam Chair, I guess just a statement first. I think this is a great bill. I think anything we can do to raise awareness, give more people an opportunity to donate. There is a process to explicitly state that you don't want to be an organ donor. The best thing you can do is tell your next of kin, who will have the ultimate decision on whether or not to donate your organs. But I will say it's troubling when we have messages out there that say, you know, someone can take your organs against your wishes. That is false. That is misleading. It's inflammatory. It's inappropriate. The reality is, if you are dead, the decision will be made by your family. If you don't have the box checked, if your family knows your wishes and they do not consent, nobody will take your organs against your wishes. Now, as someone from age 14 to age 16 that waited 2 years for a heart transplant, 6 months in the hospital when I was 15 years old, because there aren't enough organs. There aren't. And they'd be sent home until there's nothing we can do because we're never going to find you an organ in time, and now you're too sick for a transplant. Now, of the 10 people that I was at in the basement of Abbott Northwestern Hospital in 1995 while we waited for heart transplants together, I'm the only one still alive. The only one. And so, to put out that type of misinformation and to confuse the issue and to unnecessarily scare people that someone's going to come in and take your organs against your will is really, really troubling, and it's really counterproductive. Organ donation is absolutely 100% voluntary. If you do not want to be an organ donor, there are proactive steps that you can take, as Ms. Braza stated, and you can pass those wishes, much like you can in a living will or an advanced care directive, you can pass those wishes on to your family. But to come to a hearing and suggest that there's a group of people within our medical community that would assert themselves in your care and take organs against your wishes is inaccurate and inappropriate, and if that's going to be said at the testimony table, I cannot let it go unchecked.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brace.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd just like to read from Minnesota Statutes 525A.09, who may make anatomical gift of decedent's body or part, and it says, subject to paragraphs B and C, and unless barred by section 525A.07 or 525A.08, which are the revocation parts and the refusal parts, an anatomical gift of a decedent's body or part for the purpose of transplantation, therapy, research, or education may be made by any member of the following classes of persons who is reasonably available in the order of priority listed. Then it starts with an agent of the decedent, and then the spouse of the decedent, and then the adult children, and then the parent, and then the adult siblings, and then the adult grandchild. I love it. The computer just went. Okay. And then the grandparents, and then the persons who were acting as the guardians, and then an adult who exhibited special care and concern, and then 10, any other person having lawful authority to dispose of the decedent's body. Now, I will add as well that the Human Life Alliance, due to their concerns about this part of the act, created this. It is a card that people could sign and date and have, and they encourage them to carry it with them all the time. And so the only thing that I am saying about this bill is that it is an opportunity to let people know that perhaps if they don't want to check that, they should consider having a refusal form. That is the point that I am making with this testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. Representative Madison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Zerwas explained the situation quite well. I will tell you that Ms. Braze only brought up her concern to me while Representative Lesh was presenting his bill. This was the first time that I heard of this concern, and I think that it is unwarranted.
Representative Johnson, you're good? All right. Any other member questions? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Thank you for being here today. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Ozal Lapes Brown. I would like to bring to the front that my situation was I was up for adoption, and I grew up in the foster care system. And as of growing up in the foster care system, I was not adopted. I do not have a next of kin, and that is something to think about possibly. Why there might be a concern of knowing this, because me, myself, coming in here, I did not know anything about that. If you do not refuse, that my organs can be opted up. And there, with there not being next of kin, there can also be, there, you don't, if someone makes a choice for me, if the doctor makes a choice for me, that it's still my body, and I don't, without having that information, you can't move forward on anything, so.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Representative Anderson?
Madam Chair, just to alleviate your concerns, you can have a care directive that says that you do not want to have that, much like a will or anything else to that effect, but I think my testifier would like to speak to that.
Ms. Larson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Yes, I first want to respond to that and say thank you for your testimony. A physician actually cannot authorize donation. That's not one of the people in the list. The people in the list of those who can authorize donation in the absence of a decision are the same that are making your decisions on your behalf at the at that point, at the end of your life or upon your death. And so those would be the people making a decision. And any documented decision, whether it be a yes or a no, is something that we would honor, we must honor, we're incumbent. It's incumbent that we do that. I also want to share that as the organization responsible for organ and donation in Minnesota, we take very seriously our role as stewards of these gifts and our role in maintaining public trust. I lead the team at LifeSource that's responsible for all of our public education and outreach, as well as our education with our professional partners and hospital partners. And talking about donation, how people make a decision about donation, who can honor and fulfill that decision, is a very important part of the work that we do, and we take that very seriously.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas and then Representative Hillstrom.
Well, I guess I would just point out that the young man that's foster child and doesn't have a next of kin identified, I think he kind of proves my point and I guess my frustration with some of the previous misinformation. If you do not have someone as a next of kin to authorize the donation of organs on your behalf, the system, the hospital, LifeSource, the doctor, they cannot take your organs. There must be someone identified as a next of kin to allow that procedure to occur. And so it's that type of misinformation from the previous testimony that gets people concerned, confused, and scared. And it puts up barriers to organ donation and transplantation. And people die. People die every day waiting for transplants. And this misinformation does not help in the process.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
I'll pass, Madam Chair. He said it very well.
Okay. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill or any other member questions? Seeing none. All right, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Kaya Concepcion. And I just really have a question and there's a little confusion. I do understand the committee members passionate about the situation, but I think that what I didn't understand, you know, I live in Minnesota and I'm here alone, and the next of kin doesn't, you know, understand my wishes, and we're talking about, you know, care wills and living wills, and I just think that there should be clear information that is easily, like, interpreted and understood for everyone about this process, and it's not clear, and, you know, because there are a lot of questions being asked, and so that when we talk about something as serious as organ donation, you know, we have to be careful with rhetoric. I agree, absolutely, you know, but we really want to make sure that people like me or like, you know, the last person that testified, Mr. Brown, understands what's going on, and there's obviously some confusion, and I think that, you know, this passion is real, but this confusion shouldn't be taken lightly. How do we make sure that everyone understands this process? How do we make sure that everyone, you know, gets the way that this works and doesn't work? And, you know, how do we present this question to everyone in the state of Minnesota and just ask them, you know, really, just tell us, you know, in the event of your death, you know, would you like to donate your organs? I mean, I think it's a way, that's a question that we could ask, is it not?
Yes. Ms. Larson.
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for your question. So I actually point you to the bill. I think it's about line 1.21. Mm-hmm. This bill actually mandates that when people are making this decision that they have all the information about donation, so they're making a decision with information they need that is consistent with the process and the Anatomical Gift Act. When people are making the decision on the driver's license, we have information in all the driver's license office. The state of Minnesota has been quite the leader in making sure people make a decision. We also have a mandate. Every driver's ed class spends 30 minutes on donation. So we're working very hard to make sure that everybody has information about what the decision means, how they make the decision, and how they document a refusal, and also encourage them to talk to their family or their next of kin or their friends, whomever is in their circle that might be part of that decision. So I think we're working very hard to make sure that information is available, and again, it is part of this bill to make sure that your request, exactly as you stated, is fulfilled. So okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and just one more quick thing. And so you discussed driver's license. Are we also talking about state IDs? I just want to make sure that everyone has access clearly in the state of Minnesota to this information. You know, not everyone drives, and not everyone, you know, and you have people who, again, who come out of, you know, different systems, foster care systems, and so, like, how do we, I mean, you know, how do we tenaciously make sure that everyone understands this?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes, thank you. Yes, all that information is available, driver's license, ID cards. I have a 21-year-old son who's chosen not to drive, has an ID card, has gotten all of the same information. So, yes, I believe that's very important, okay. And it is all consistent.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, you're
thank
welcome.
Thank you for your testimony. You. Mm-hmm. Seeing no other members of the audience or members around the table, questions? Representative Lohmer renews her motion that House File 1182 be re-referred to the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Anderson. You're
thank
on
you,
your way
Chair.
To transportation. Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas, would you like to move your bill, House File 2803, and recommend that it be re-referred to Public Safety and Crime Prevention?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion. And I also have the A16-0974 amendment.
All right, and would you like to move that?
I would, Madam Chair.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A16-0974, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. House File 2803 is before us as amended.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 2803 deals with 72-hour holds and notification provisions if someone is going to be released early or walks away from a 72-hour hold. And so a concern that we've seen in some instances is if a law enforcement agency gets called to an individual who's having a mental health care crisis, is brought to a medical facility for a 72-hour hold. There are some instances where within a short period of time, maybe a few hours or maybe 12 or 18 or 20 hours into that 72-hour hold, the person has recovered quite significantly, and the person is either discharged or leaves the facility against medical advice. This bill would require, it's clarifying language for what's already in statute, it would require the medical facility to let the submitting agency know that the individual that's left the hospital or is leaving the hospital is doing so within that 72-hour period. The concern is a lot of times you might have law enforcement respond to an incident where an individual is at home, maybe an adult child or maybe a domestic issue, or the person is having a mental health care episode, is put on a 72-hour hold. But if they're released within that time period, that submitting agency, for health and safety reasons, should be notified, because oftentimes what happens is that individual, that adult child at the home, or spouse or significant other, will go back to the home or the location of the original cause, and the reporting party often, or the law enforcement agency, believes that they're still in the custody of the hospital facility as a part of what they believe will be a 72-hour stay. And so it's a health safety issue. I have with me the police chief from St. Anthony who would like to testify a little bit on why the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association is supportive of the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
John Ohl with the St. Anthony Police Department, Madam Chair, members. In my time as the president of Hennepin County Chiefs of Police Association, we became aware of the actual law. What we're asking for here is a clarification. We've worked with the four major hospitals in Hennepin County with Leah Kaiser, who is the Criminal Justice Behavior Health Area Manager, along with Bill Neiman, who's a assistant county attorney with Hennepin. We kind of did the road show and went to the major hospitals and made them both aware of the current state statute, as well as and at the time found that they were a little bit uncomfortable with some of the possibilities. First, they were very comfortable with the fact that the state statute, as it currently states, that they have to notify law enforcement if someone's released prior to the expiration of a 72-hour hold. Two things came to mind for the hospitals, one of which was, what if the person is never taken in, just triaged on the transport hold and then released? And the other one is, what if the individual that's on a transport hold from law enforcement voluntarily goes into the program and then is released prior to the expiration of 72 hours. In those two circumstances, they didn't feel the current state statute language allowed them to make the notification that clearly, I think, is the intent of the law.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 2803 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and your testifier. Next up, Representative Smith. Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, we just out of curiosity, since Representative Hoppe's not here, have we killed a bill yet in this committee?
No, and we may want to do it because this is a huge change he's making here to this bill today. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill? Why is it back here? And then explain why it's back here.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith has moved House File 2294. Is there an amendment?
Yes, there is. It is titled...
I believe it's the A-16?
That is correct.
Representative Smith moves the A-16-0847. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-16-0847, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. The bill has been amended. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be with you today. This bill is back before us because there was obsolete terminology found in the bill. A line item 1.20, the last word in the sentence, the words records is, the word statistics is no longer a word used by the reviser office. So they have asked us to change the word statistics to records. That is the only change to this bill, Madam Chair. I ask for your support.
All right. Pretty controversial. Any member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 2294 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1560.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen has moved House File 1560 and recommend that it be re-referred to the General Register. Please go ahead and explain your bill.
I have an amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen would like to move the A-16-0975. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The A-16-0975 has been amended on to 1560. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. What this bill does, it seeks to add clarification to the release of medical records based on Minnesota law. The some clinics, at least the one that I'm familiar with, already does what this bill intends, and that is... many of the forms that are available for release of medical records for a number of different conditions just have one place to sign with no explanation of that you can opt out, all right? And what this bill would do is require that each area of release would be initialed by the patient, encouraging them to understand the implication of the release of their medical records. It's a privacy issue. The with electronic medical records and a number of other things out there, the ease of transferring your medical records and who has access to them in terms of medical privacy, I think is an important issue. This would add clarity to that. With that, I do have a testifier.
All right, please come forward. Good morning, Ms. Braze. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze, President of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I have, if the page would distribute these.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So Citizens Council for Health Freedom often receives copies of consent forms from concerned persons, patients. These consent to treat forms often include, as Representative Grunhagen said, a roster of other items to which patients are essentially required to consent if they want access to care. And that's because there's only one line for the patient's signature and nothing giving them the right to say no on the other items in the list. So in the packet that you are receiving, you'll see several things, including examples of consent forms. So there's one consent form here by Health Partners that we received, and once you get the opportunity to look at that, you'll see at the very top of it, it says, we cannot accept changes to this form. So the person who gave us this was perturbed that she could not be limited in what she gave access to in order to give care, or in order to get care. So given Minnesota's strong medical privacy laws, we look at these consolidated consent forms as the way hospitals and clinics get around the various consent requirements in Minnesota state law today. Requirements that are stronger than those in the federal HIPAA privacy rule. So the right of consent means you have a choice, and if you don't have a choice, that's not actually consent. It is a bit of a coercive consent. As an example of this lack of choice, the North Memorial form, which you have in your hands now, shows 9 items, including consent for treatment in item A. At the very end, you're asked to sign a statement that says, I consent to all of the above. Above that single signature, patients are forced to consent at B to HIV testing if a physician decides they should be tested. C is problematic because Minnesotans by law must be asked for their consent to have data shared and used for payment, for treatment, and for healthcare operations, as the Mayo Notice of Privacy Practices shows. And if you're looking at that notice, which I can't seem to find, I must have given mine. Oh, here we go. Right here. The important thing to notice is not the words, which are really, really tiny, but the color. So the color that is red is where Minnesota law differs from HIPAA, and 8 of those instances is where Minnesota requires consent and HIPAA does not. So, again, real consent means you have a choice, but the single signature forces the patient to agree despite how broadly defined these terms are. For example, you may not know that healthcare operations under HIPAA is a 390-word definition. The single signature subjects patients at D to medical and genetic research, and their only option is to later submit a written objection. Health Partners does it better if you look at their form. They have a box to check, but it's a dissent, an opt-out, not a request for authorization as required by Minnesota Statute 144.295. Again, the Mayo Clinic Notice of Privacy Practices notes this distinction between HIPAA and Minnesota law, if you care to look at that form. E in the North Memorial form appears careless. Do patients really want their presence disclosed to anyone who may inquire about them by name? How about a starstruck fan, or a vengeful ex, or a political opponent? Yet that's what could happen under the single signature. And F is only intended to give legal protection against patients who lose property at the facility. So with one signature, patients give up these rights in order to access care.
Might this provision also protect the hospital if the patient's medical data is stolen or breached by hackers? G and I on the form are sweeping authorizations to get care the patient is forced to agree to significant releases of information, including to hospitals, clinics, and providers unrelated to North Memorial, such as other providers or accountable care organizations in which North Memorial participates. Again, one signature, no choice. H discusses the notice of privacy practices, but patients can refuse to sign this statement and still be treated. As the U.S. Office of Civil Rights states in number 4 on this document, which you also have in your handout, number 4 is in the back. So what's missing that should be in this consent form? We feel that consent for use of a record locator service as required by Minnesota Statute 144.293 Subdivision 8. North Memorial's Notice of Privacy Practices says it may access and share health information electronically through a health information exchange. The RLS, the Record Locator Service, is considered a key component of such data exchange. Also missing is an option for the patient to not share data with their health plan if they pay cash. That's a right that cash payers have under HIPAA. So we mailed a letter to North Memorial's CEO on February 26, 2015, but we never received a response to our questions. House File 1560 is an important bill that will assure Minnesotans that their consent rights under current Minnesota law will not be violated. We have found a shining example of what this should look like. The Silverman Ankle and Foot Clinic, which is part of the Allina Integrated Medical Network located in Minneapolis, already gives patients these itemized yes and no options. And you have that as well in your packet. So if healthcare facilities choose to have these consolidated forms, these types of yes and no choices should be standard practice, allowing Minnesotans to exercise their legal rights to consent or refuse to consent. These state-mandated choices are already theirs under Minnesota law, but these consent forms continually violate those legal patient privacy and consent rights by requiring a single signature and giving no choices. We ask you to vote yes on House File 1560. We know there are additional testimony in your packets, or we have one from, I guess we sent ours out from Amy Klein, but Dr. Stephen Huey, a psychologist, also provided testimony, and then Sandy here is also here to testify.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and if you could go ahead and state your testimony, that'd be great, and introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Sandra K. Simonson, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have been a licensed independent clinical social worker for 22-plus years and a social worker for 30-plus years. I have also taught social work as adjunct faculty. I support House File 1560 as it promotes better informed and empowered healthcare consumers. I view the danger of blanket releases, as we term them in the healthcare community and in the social work community, as so concerning that I spent numerous hours over 3 weeks last March studying the changes that were implemented within HIPAA in late 2013 so that within my own private mental health therapy practice, I could adopt a standard of practice regarding disclosure. I developed such standards to guard against the request of records based on blanket release and to better inform my clients of their legal rights. I made such an extensive effort to do so, and I am here today because the Code of Ethics of Social Work prompts me to do so. Healthcare consumers are unclear of their rights regarding their medical data and how their data may be shared and used since changes have been made at the federal level in recent years. We also can't be naive that since late 2013, medical data has become big money both for those with legal and illegal intent. Most healthcare consumers do not realize that there is ways that their medical data can be used to be sold, and they're not aware of how much their information can be used even for fundraising purposes. So there is quite a lot of unknowns for healthcare consumers. This proposed law will allow healthcare consumers to be better informed of their rights and with whom their medical data is being shared. The changes made at the federal level in late 2013 were done to improve treatment, to not have obstacles of medical knowledge to offer treatment, not to create huge medical data banks, which blanket releases allow. Thank you for your attention to this crucial matter.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions from members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be real quick. Just a question for Representative Grunhagen about the last sentence that the provider can condition receipt on patient's willingness to release records. And I just want to find out, I guess I'm not saying that I'd agree or disagree, but I'm just curious about your response. Why not have the business, because I think of you as supporting freedom for businesses too, so why not have the business be able to decide whether or not it wants to provide treatment based on this?
Well,
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that question, Representative Pinto. My understanding is, and I could have Twyla comment on it too, is that the law already requires that if you don't agree to all the things on the consent form, that they still have to give you treatment. This statement's in there just to clarify the point that if you decide that some of these release areas, you do not initial them, therefore do not allow the release of them, you can still receive treatment. We have had some reports in the previous testimony where people were told that if they didn't sign the form, they're not going to get treatment, and this simply clarifies that point.
Everybody good? Any other questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 1560 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. You are on your way to the General Register. Thank you so much. Representative Hamilton, can you do your bill like in 3 minutes?
I can do my bill in 1 minute. So we have
Representative Hamilton, thank you for being here. I will move House File 2345.
So,
and there is an amendment. Just a second here.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's a technical amendment to get the bill in
right.
Shape I'd like it.
Okay. Let me find the amendment, and we will name it. I will move the A1 amendment, the H2345A1 amendment. All those in favor, or any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, to your bill.
Madam Chair and Committee, many people have come together on this. This is an interpreter's bill. Many people and groups have come together. I haven't seen any opposition at this point. We've come a long way. I don't have any testifiers today. We're checking all the boxes. That's why we're here. And I'll stand for questions.
All right. Any member questions on this file? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 2345 as amended be referred to the General to GovOps and Elections Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. You're on your way to GovOps. Thank you,
Representative
Hamilton. Members, we are adjourned. Yeah.